the Welcome to Connecting the Dots, host Mark Shane. And we're here today with Rod Bennett. And of course, we're taking this, we're taking this day to remember as all people who were alive that day remember, May 25th, 1977, over a million officers, pilots, crew lost their lives in the terrorist attack on the Death Star. And, we all remember where we were, what we were doing. I was at a movie when we got the news.
That's right. Actually, Star Wars didn't open in Atlanta for another week or so after that. So, I knew it was coming, but I'm not sure I knew just what it was yet. That was an interesting week. Looking forward to seeing it, but not knowing what it was really.
I had not heard a thing about it. Just I was oblivious. Yeah. And so and a friend of mine say, "Hey, you want to go see Star Wars?" And I was like, "What's that?" And they said it was, some kind of science fiction-y thing. I thought, okay. And you have to remember that the 70s were really like a really bleak period.
Yeah. For science fiction meant something different in 1976 than it does now.
It was a really, there was like, beginning with Fahrenheit 451, which is like a decade earlier, mid 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then on through Planet of the Apes, you get films like Silent Running and
It was the great age of cautionary science fiction.
Yeah, it was just like all these depressing stories,
Well, people wanted to be serious in the 60s. They did after binging on cotton candy in the 50s. They all decided about the same time to start taking life more seriously.
Yeah.
So there's some good films in that cycle. But they all had a similar tone.
Yeah,
if the closest thing to a
sucks and it's all going to get worse.
if the closest thing to a fun science fiction movie before Star Wars was Planet of the Apes, in the Planet of the Apes series, the world is destroyed not once but twice.
Yeah,
that was just about the closest thing there was to a fun action adventure sci-fi.
Yeah, I got to give it to. Planet of the Apes, it had the great Rod Serling twist ending. It was written
absolutely. It's the big Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah, it is.
The one in CinemaScope and color.
And it had, Charlton Heston chewing the scenery and all of that, But I was willing to give it a try because, sure, why not? But I went in with like zero expectations. And this is back in the days before you had the big Cinemaplex 2000, 16 screens filling up, 10 acres of your neighborhood strip mall.
Yeah.
And there was just one theater in Seattle that showed Star Wars.
Star Wars was considered to have a very wide opening when it came out. It opened in 400 theaters nationwide.
Yep.
Today, a wide opening is like 2,800. So,
So we went downtown to the UA 150 Cinema, the late lamented. I went on to work there a few years later when I was in college. And it was this huge theater with these two gigantic Cinerama screens. Two entire theaters together in the same building. Unthinkable. There was nobody had ever seen such a thing at the time. And so we went there. I still had like zero expectations, and I was used to, you go, you pay your ticket, you walk in the theater. Well, we got there, and there was a line that stretched down to the corner and then all the way down the block, and then all the way down the block again.
Right.
And then turned a corner and went halfway down that block. And it was like, you got to be kidding me. So we got in line. It was a beautiful day in May. And we stood there for 2 hours. And then the line surged forward, and we walked up around the block and down the block, and then we stopped. Yeah, we sat there for 2 more hours.
And I thought, but you did get the encouragement of seeing the previous audience come out. One of my most vivid memories of seeing people pouring out of the previous showing, all of them were beaming, big smiles on their faces. Yeah. It's just a corner had been turned. And it was, so you, that was encouraging.
Yeah. So, you know, well, and I remember sitting there thinking, you know, looking at my friend and saying, this better be pretty damn good.
Better be good after all this ballyhoo.
Well, the thing is, I'd not heard any ballyhoo. I was really going cold. I'd never seen a preview for it. No one had ever mentioned it until the day it came out. And in my knowledge. And so we went in. I, of course, like everybody, I was like blown away. I loved it from the moment of the opening crawl. I thought, this is like, you know, Flash Gordon. I mean, it was like that.
Exactly. And, it's like Flash Gordon made by, what would Flash Gordon look like if it had been made by David Lane?
Yeah.
That's pretty much the whole joke.
Yep. So, sat there, enjoyed every second of it thoroughly. I must have gone back to see that movie a dozen times. It wound up playing in the Everett Theater. That's actually where I'm from, is a little town called Everett, just north of Seattle. So it wound up playing there, and I'd save up a couple of bucks because I was working over the summer, and I'd go see it again. This is back when you literally could, you know, you laugh, you cry, you kiss $3 goodbye. And so just a wonderful time. And I saw it, You Poor Kids, today. I saw it before George Lucas improved it. And oodles. I don't even know if it's possible to get just the original Star Wars as it appeared in the theaters in
1960. It is the core, pretty close. The original, a couple of years back, the DVD that I think came out in 2008 or something, had as an extra the original theatrical cut. The quality's not as nice as today's Blu-rays or anything like that, but still very, very watchable. It's the old Laserdisc transfer from when I had a Laserdisc player. So
that's it.
But it is so true. It's not, it's a myth that the other version has been suppressed. It is available.
That's good. Well, as the galaxy mourns the terrible events of this day in 1977. By the way, I learned a new word the other day. We had Simca on the show, and she asked her readers for, like, just give me a word. I'll see if I could work it into the conversation. So people were putting out tons of just different obscure words, names of, you know, long names of Welsh villages and things like this. And one of the words that they gave her was galactagogue. Wow. And I thought, or galactagogue. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. I think it's galactagogue. But anyway, so we were trying to guess what that might mean. And it turns out that a galactagogue is any substance that a woman ingests that increases lactation.
How about that?
So there you go. So now you know why it's called the Milky Way.
Oh, no.
So, no. I'm pleased with myself, and I have no regrets. So... So there you go. You know, and speaking of Star Wars, watch how I segue into this. Someone should really write a book about movies and their impact on culture from a Catholic Christian perspective. Don't you agree, Rod?
You know, Mark, it's funny you should say that.
Do tell.
Well, folks, Mark has set me up for a nice commercial for my new book, which is now available on Amazon. This is the thing a couple of weeks back I hinted that we had an announcement to make. My new book is called The Popcorn Cathedral, and it is a collection of essays of mine that have been put together from various magazine articles that I published over the last couple of decades, and there it is all about being a geeky Christian and looking at fantasy and sci-fi type stuff from a Christian perspective. C.S. Lewis had a little quote that really struck me some time before this, where he said, "What we really need is not more little books about Christianity, but more little books about other subjects with their Christianity latent." And that was a pretty big breakthrough, as simple as it may sound to some folks. It was a big breakthrough for somebody raised in the Puritan tradition, as I was. And it set me off reconciling the various aspects of my life, my great loves, to my Christian faith. In the introduction to the book, I say that I had always grown up to and being told that Jesus has to be the Lord of your life. And I always took that to mean Jesus has to be your number one, the number one thing in your life instead. Mm-hmm. In other words, Jesus has to be number one instead of what I later found out it to be, is Jesus Lord and number one over everything. He's the Lord in every aspect of your life. So if you're a film fan, he's the Lord of that aspect of your life, rather than you know, being, you should, instead of watching movies, you should be out going to church or something.
Right, right.
That's the gist of the essays in the book, which we can talk about later.
Incarnational faith. Yeah. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett. And we'll be back talking about the Popcorn Cathedral and other things right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Hello there, yours. Welcome as can be. Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett, the author of, most recently, The Popcorn Cathedral, which, by the way, major props for that title. That's a great title, Popcorn Cathedral. That's
if you've ever been in one of the great movie palaces, especially the ones from the 1920s that feel like the inside of a church, you know.
Oh, yeah.
It definitely suggests the junction of the two things, faith and fantasy and film. So, So that's where it came from.
Cool. Well, I want to invite readers to give us a call. Readers,
wake up, too.
Listeners can also give us a call. Or, you know, if you're just stalkers, I mean, you can feel free, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And you can also text us at that number, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And you can tweet us at Breadbox Media, because that's our tweet handle. And anyway, before we went to break, we were talking a little bit about the Popcorn Cathedral. And it is, you know, it's true. I mean, we get so much of the way we look at the world comes to us from movies. How much of our conversation is, you know, relies on movie references, you know, or you know, it's sort of bastard godchild television. References. So much of the way that we mediate reality to ourselves, we've become a visual culture. We get most of our information about the way the world works from visual media. We read less and less. Which is to say, of course, you should turn your book into a series of videos.
Probably so.
Yeah.
It is a Kindle, so you can read it on a screen if you'd like to.
Okay, well, that's the important thing then. As long as there's a screen. And then, you know, you just like random pictures throughout the text, you know. Marilyn Monroe standing over the, you know, the grate with her dress getting blown up and stuff like that, you know. and Death Star is also blowing up, but in a different way. Yeah. But
well, pictures are good when you're talking about film, no doubt about it.
Yeah. So
it's interesting to me the degree to which, you know, a lot of people have heard the silly, and it is silly, it's people clowning around, you know, on a census they list that their religion is Jedi, you know.
Right.
The all of that's pretty silly, but it is interesting to me to watch the way that our younger generation, people my age and younger, have started treating the Bible in a very, sorry, have started treating Star Wars in a very similar way to the way that the Bible was used in the Middle Ages and up until, you know, maybe the 19th century. It's become a kind of a religious text that you can count on everybody knowing something about.
Oh, yeah.
You can do quotes and stuff. Right. And the degree to which, I don't know, the Middle Ages, illiteracy was very common.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons, in fact, why our churches from that period and the ones that have imitated since then have so many pictures, stained glass windows and Stations of the Cross and all of that, is that this was the Bible turned into movies, so to speak.
Right.
In other words, it was put out, the stories were put out there for the common man to interact with in a way that he wasn't able to in those days when the Bible was hard to read, expensive. So, but people quoted each other and capped each other's quotations about these stories in a very, you know, stories of David and Saul and, you know, all the great Bible stories were the kind of religious text that of mythology, of stories that people use to illustrate each other's experiences. And people nowadays use Star Wars in a very similar way. People of a certain age and group, they cap each other's quotations and all the rest of it, and they genuinely talk about the myths and the metaphors and the themes and the stories to illustrate religious and spiritual ideas that they find important. And I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and that's something, you know, in a certain sense, that's something that any widely known piece of literature or culture will, that's one of the uses that we always put any widely known
that's very true, but Star Wars is unusually religious.
Well, right, because it actually does,
yeah, it's explicitly religious in a it's a fantasy religion, of course, but it you know, it is essentially a piece of religious mythology.
Right. Yeah, and so its language is easily incorporated because it's simple. It's proposing, you know, very broad categories. So, you know, when I just about said Darth Cheney. When Dick Cheney.
So your political bias comes out in everything.
Well, when Dick Cheney, you know, talks about having to go to the dark side in wartime, that's what he's talking about. He's drawing explicitly from that cultural reference, and
while explicitly rejecting the message of
that. Exactly. Well, basically saying I want to be like Darth Vader, and so there's that, you know, that goes on. But we do this all the time. I mean, any widely shared text. So, you know, 100 years ago, English speakers could and did do the same thing with, you know, characters out of Dickens.
Right.
And we still do that to a certain degree. So, you know, if I tell you that so-and-so is a real Scrooge, everybody knows what I mean by that.
Right, right.
100 years ago from now, it's anybody's guess as to, you know, you get a lot of people, you know, if I say that somebody is a real Mr. Micawber now, I'll get a lot of scratching heads. A lot of people are not going to know what I'm talking about if I reference Mr. Micawber, but they still recognize Scrooge. You know, we can still get away with our language is still permeated with Shakespeare, so we can still do that. And our language is still permeated with biblical references. A lot of people don't know that they're biblical references anymore.
Right.
So if we say that a leopard can't change his spots, people still understand what that means, but they don't know that it comes from Jeremiah anymore. So that's still there, but you know, when we talk about, you know, in day-to-day parlance, a lot of our parlance comes out of the movies now. The movies change so quickly and their popularity waxes and wanes. I mean, there are some movies that are what my kids would call old movies, and I would call it movies from my youth. You know? When I think of an old movie, I'm thinking of black and white with, you know, Cary Grant in it, you know, or
when we first moved into our old neighborhood that we lived in, we had neighbors that came over to welcome us, and, you know, we were chatting about things we were interested in, common interests, and I mentioned that I liked old movies. And the next door lady said, "Oh, that's great. We do too. Well, one of my favorites is like an Officer and a Gentleman."
Yeah.
This was the 90s, by the way. So when this happened, so the movie was 10 years or something old. And I hated to break it to her, but I told her, you know, at our house, if it's got sound, it's not old.
Yeah.
Well, I think she understood what I meant.
I remember somebody pointing out one time that, you know, we used to speak of the 12th century, the 13th century, the 14th, 15th, 16th century. Now we talk about the 60s and the 70s. Yeah, we're dividing up time. And you know, now, I mean, it's like, well, that was before Obama. You know, 8 years, that's not, you know, that's just a blink of an eye.
It is interesting how some movies get old and others don't, though. It seemed like that's where you were headed. Star Wars is one of those movies that's perennial. It does seem old to some people, but it lives in a way that most other movies that came out in 1977 don't.
Yeah.
But there are several others like that, too. Wizard of Oz, for example. Many people are absolutely shocked to hear that The Wizard of Oz came out like 78 years ago.
Really?
Now, some of that has to do with the fact that the color is so beautiful, you know, and they've spent so much time and effort to keep it looking nice and stuff, you know. But that movie came out in 1939. I mean, it came out before World War II. And a lot of people are very surprised to hear it. And it's because it seems everybody knows that it's old, but probably most people think maybe the 50s, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a movie that, because there's something about it that's timeless.
Yeah.
And I think Star Wars will have a similar quality.
Well, yeah. And I think that that's true because it's, you know, it's asking, it's dealing in these sort of broad comic book strokes. You know, one of the things that is interesting to watch as well is, and I've seen actually, you know, discussions of course, something like Shakespeare is you know, the language is difficult for moderns, but in addition to that, you know, there are really deep tectonic cultural shifts that I wonder how Shakespeare is going to weather them in some place, you know. So, I mean, the whole, well, we'll get back to it when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. I'm here today with Rod Bennett. And
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Hello, and welcome. Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Rod Bennett, the author of The Popcorn Cathedral. Just all around raconteur and fun guy.
Yeah, all the audience is thinking, I'll be the judge of that.
We were having a conversation over the break, which reminded me of a priest that I know came to a priestly vocation somewhat late in life. And I asked him if there was anything that he missed about being a lay person. He said, yeah, I missed the Mass. Because he no longer has, yeah, he said he no longer has the luxury of, you know, sitting out there in the pew and using Mass as a time for meditation and focus, because he's got to do the Mass.
He's in charge.
He's in charge. This is his duty. He's got to do the Mass, get it right, and et cetera. And, you know, praying is kind of, he's leading the prayer, but the chance for interior meditation is, you know, greatly reduced. You really give up something when you become a priest. And so I always thought that was profound. And you were remarking before the break about poor George Lucas. Tell folks what you were saying.
Yeah, I was just saying they harshly criticize George's special editions and the fact that he can't seem to quit tinkering with his movies. What they're not realizing maybe is that George is kind of a sad character because he's the only person in the world that never got to see Star Wars. Yeah. Star Wars was never new to him. It never blew him away the way you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
He was there. He was there from the first millisecond.
Yep.
And so therefore he never got to see it when it was fresh and new. So his outlook on it is completely different than that of anybody else in the world. And one of the ways that this took shape was in talking about the changes he made to the special editions, he said, it was frustrating to me because when the movie was getting ready to come out, I was so sad and depressed. He said, I felt like I'd only got about 25% of what I had envisioned onto the screen. And, you know, when you hear this, you and I, as ordinary lay people, want to say, well, gee, George, you know, that's a shame. If you managed to get more of what you envisioned up there, who knows, the damn thing might have been a big hit. And yeah. I think that's it. It was the classic example of a guy too close to the thing to see the forest for the trees, you know. He went back in Return of the Jedi, the number 3 movie, and gave us a bigger, better cantina scene. You know, the cantina bar with all the crazy aliens. Mm-hmm. He gave us a bigger, lavish, more lavish, better costumes, et cetera, a version of the idea, and nobody really cares much for it. And the difference is it was brand new, and however crudely done, it was the idea that was totally fresh and interesting and cool in the original, and it can never be that again, no matter how much better technically it is, you know.
Yeah.
So I tend to take pity on George in things like this because, like I say, he comes from a very strange perspective when it comes to Star Wars. He's the priest that never gets to go to Mass anymore.
The poor man.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, and you know, really, that's the thing is, and this is true of any artist in a certain sense. I mean, he really is a kind of a priest. I mean, part of what does a priest do? A priest is a mediator. He mediates, in the case of a Catholic priest, he mediates God to man and man to God. That's what any artist is doing in another way, is he's mediating reality to us through his imagination or through her imagination. And in the process of that, if he's really good, the better the artist, as he does that, he's also going to be, inevitably, he's going to be mediating something of God to us as well, because he's a sub-creator.
That's the term Professor Tolkien used, that you have the dignity of participating in some small way in what God did when he created.
Right. And so our art is going to tend to reflect something of God to us. Something of the Paschal mystery tends to come to us, especially through our stories. Never perfectly and often very badly distorted, but I've sometimes, you know, in the past have said it's, I wouldn't so much call the gospel the greatest story ever told as more or less the only story ever told. It's, you just right. keep running into the Paschal mystery in our stories, you know? And so, you know, take your pick. I mean, Dorothy's longing to get home is a reflection of our desire for our heavenly home. And, you know, what's E.T.? Well, E.T. is the story of a being who comes down from heaven, befriends children, has the power to heal, dies, rises from the dead, and ascends.
Well, into later appears in white, glowing white robes with a
yes.
glowing.
Yes. You know? and tells his disciple that he will be with him always before he ascends into the heavens. Where have we heard that story before? You know, yep. Sometimes the story is consciously told in reflection of the Paschal mystery. So Tolkien makes clear that The Lord of the Rings was a Catholic story. It's not an allegory. He didn't like allegory. But it's certainly a story that is deeply influenced by his Catholicism, and he says consciously so.
Right. It's interesting when you said E.T., when all of those things that you pointed out were pointed out to Steven Spielberg not long after the movie came out. A reviewer said, gee, Steven, there's an awful lot of Christian stuff in this. Spielberg being somewhat famously known for his Judaism. Mm-hmm. And he his kind of jokey response was, oh, no, don't say that. My my nice Jewish mother, her feelings will be hurt. And but he did later. He agreed that a lot of it was in there, but he said he thought a lot of it was unconscious. Mm-hmm. But he did remember that. He did remember that the glowing heart image probably did come from the fact that when he was young, he saw Catholic postcards with the Sacred Heart of Jesus. Right.
Yeah, and so. I remember Orson Welles remarked on Close Encounters of the Third Kind when it came out. He said, you know, this is the New Jerusalem, you know, coming down out of heaven. The great mothership as it descends, you know, this is, you know, Judeo-Christian imagery shining through. And that comes, and if you're going to tell a good story, it's going to be a story that's going to reflect the Paschal mystery. And so over and over again, you have heroes who sacrifice themselves for the good of their beloved. Well, you know,
right.
Where have you heard that story before? You know,
I did a series of talks some years back at Cornerstone Festival, a big Christian rock festival that also had a film track. It was called King Kong Died for Your Sins. And it was all about this phenomenon of the Christ figure that reappears in fantasy and sci-fi movies over and over again.
Right.
And about how, which part of it was conscious, which part of it was unconscious, and kind of reached the same conclusion that the early fathers did. People like Justin Martyr and Origen and Clement of Alexandria puzzled over the fact and were challenged over the fact that a lot of the elements of the Christ story are present in pre-Christian mythology.
Sure.
In other words, a lot of the old pagan myths were essentially the pre-Christian version of Star Wars. They were people sitting around coming up with stirring, mysteriously moving stories that seem to bespeak of another world and take you out of your day-to-day reality. And these early fathers, they were being asked in a kind of an accusatory way, you know, how come your God who dies and comes back to life and your virgin-born Savior, how come these things are all in pre-Christian mythology? Mm-hmm. And the early fathers said, well, it would be surprising if that were not the truth. In other words, if God is real and his plan was to cause the myths to become fact one day, mm-hmm. that there would be something in God that continuously speaks to the human heart so that even totally pagan poets and creators sort of participate in the gift of prophecy. In other words, their hearts cry out for the fulfillment and the filling of the aching hole at the center of all human hearts, and they create satisfying dreams to fill that hole up with. And it's not too surprising that they look look like the real Jesus. So my contention in these speeches was that the process has not stopped now that Christ has come in the flesh, simply because a lot of people are cut off from that. For whatever reason, they don't are unwilling to listen to Christians or whatever. But this doesn't stop them from being human beings who, when they look for the most satisfying story they can find, they tend to recreate that greatest story ever told. So
right.
Yeah, so it's a fascinating subject.
Yeah, and it's fun because it does keep showing. There's a talk that I've given in the past that sort of goes through that way in which the Paschal mystery keeps reasserting itself in our stories. Because we're built to look for it. You know, as Augustine says, you've made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. And so our stories are going to reflect that. And stories that make an effort to reject that pattern tend to just suck as stories. They're just bad stories, you know?
Right.
So anyway, we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here today with Rod Bennett, and we'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. We've been talking about his new book, The Popcorn Cathedral, which is an awesome title for a book. And before we go any further, just wanted to ask you, where can people go to get The Popcorn Cathedral again?
Well, probably the easiest way to get it is you can Google it on Amazon.com, but my preferred way to send you to it, to the Just Google my name, Rod Bennett, and the word author, Rod Bennett author, and the first thing that comes up will be the link to my author site.
Okay. Now we were talking
for an essay for free on the site. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we were talking before the break about talking a little bit about the Gospels. There was a little interesting conversation that came up on your Facebook wall that comes up now and then. Unbelievers buy and many Catholics are intimidated by. And I sort of thought it would be useful to talk about. One of the things you run into sometimes are people who will tell you, well, you know, Jesus, the people who are skeptical of Christianity or people who are doubtful about their own faith often have a perception, kind of this evolutionary picture of Jesus. So Jesus, you know, the real Jesus, the historical Jesus, was just this rabbi who went around saying inscrutable things, and then he was tragically killed, and his disciples had a particularly robust sense of delusion. And so they expanded him over time from this rabbi into God. And so if you read the early Gospels, you can see a church that, you know, doesn't think that Jesus is God. They think that he's, you know, somehow important in some supernatural way. And they tell, you know, fake miracle stories about him. But then later on, when you get to the last Gospel, John is like totally in the tank for Jesus is God. And so that's what's going on when you're reading the Gospels. It's very common to hear people talk this
used
way.
used to be used as an argument that got very late, like 250 AD or something. And of course that has been completely proved wrong just by somebody dates it that late anymore. But
Right.
But yeah, that was one of the arguments, was that it couldn't have a Christology this, at least in the first century AD, because everybody knows that came later. This is called begging the question,
by the way. Right. Yeah. And, you know, but the thing is that that whole argument depends on a fair amount of historical ignorance. So the first piece of historical ignorance it depends on is the notion that the Gospels are written first. They sort of work through their issues until they're able to expand Jesus from being just a nice rabbi who did magic tricks to God in the fourth Gospel. And then the rest of the New Testament was sort of written as commentary on those four Gospels. And this whole way of approaching the development of the Catholic tradition is completely unhistorical. It has no bearing on the actual reality of how Catholic tradition developed. Because, in fact, the Gospels are among the last things written in the New Testament. And the letters of Paul, and virtually every other letter except the book of Revelation, precedes the Gospels. So Paul's letters are... Paul's dead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it may be that the believe that Matthew's Gospel, excuse me, that may have come out 10 years or so after the death of Christ. So about... Possible. Paul, you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, they certainly don't precede the earlier letters of Paul. No right. Gospel precedes the early
Paul. Right. And Paul's letters are written to communities that have already received the gospel. They've already heard the preaching of the gospel. And the earliest thing that every Christian community hears is... exactly what the skeptic says didn't come along until John wrote his gospel. But in fact, on Pentecost and immediately afterwards, what people are hearing, and the core thing that they're hearing, is not Jesus once told a nice story about the prodigal son, or, you know, Jesus went somewhere and healed a deaf guy. That's not the story that's being told. The first thing and the main thing that every Christian preacher that goes out is talking about, and certainly every apostle that goes out is talking about, is Jesus Christ is God, and he was raised from the dead after being crucified. That's it. I mean, that's the core of what the church has to say right at the beginning. And this is clearly reflected in what Paul has to write. So Paul calls Jesus Lord. He tells us that Jesus, in him all the fullness of the Godhead dwells. And this is long before John sets pen to paper. Paul,
yeah, this is all stuff saying that supposedly didn't come about until much later. Constantine, right. Some people.
Right. And in fact, when you look at the earliest gospel, what most scholars are willing to argue is the first gospel that really takes shape is the Gospel of Mark. And so Mark is, you know, agreed on by most scholars as being the earliest gospel. And it's in Mark that we have this moment where Jesus is on trial before the Sanhedrin, and they ask him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" And it's in Mark. Jesus doesn't give, in other synoptic gospels, Jesus gives these oblique answers. "You have said," is one of the expressions that he uses to address both the Sanhedrin. It's an affirmative, but it's meant to be an oblique affirmative. But in the Gospel of Mark, you don't get that. You get Jesus' reply there, and he says, "I am," which is a hugely loaded reply. It doesn't just mean I'm pleading yes to the question you just asked me, but he's like driving that answer home with a sledgehammer, because "I am" is the name of God in Hebrew. And so this notion that Jesus never claimed to be God.
Say out loud.
Yeah, and And when the answer to that question is going to decide the difference between walking out of that trial or having nails driven through his feet and hands. And in Mark's gospel, right, the earliest gospel, Jesus' reply to that question is, I am. Does Jesus claim to be God? Absolutely, Jesus claims to be God. This is not some late development that comes up later in the tradition.
I do think it might be worthwhile to give the devil his due here a little bit. It absolutely is true that the way in which the synoptic is similar to the other synoptic gospels and quite a bit different than what John is doing.
Right.
Absolutely, completely different. And the openness and the willing to say these things in a very, very, very... it's unique to John's gospel rather than to the other three.
Mm-hmm.
And this does need to be accounted for somehow. Mm-hmm. There's various ways of doing. My personal opinion is the best answer is entirely rooted in who the different books were written to.
Right.
And the idea is that the synoptic gospels were written for inquirers, curious non-Christians, written as evangelistic gospel to speak to the Hebraic Jews of the Holy Land, the Mark's gospel to speak to the dispersed Jews,
mm-hmm.
and tends to be focused on out-and-out pagans. But John's gospel, and almost all scholars are agreed on this, is written to the Christian community itself, written to baptized believers, mature Christians. And has a frankness to it that's in-house, if you see what I'm saying.
And if
and
I can
it
add
just so happens
something.
That we have... Yeah, go ahead.
If I could add something here. It's also almost certainly written to the community at Ephesus. There are internal reasons for that, to think that. Among them, for example, John spends a lot of time making clear to his audience that John the Baptist is not the Messiah and Jesus is. And we know from the book of Acts that there was, in fact, a community. In fact, they're still around. They're called the Mendeans, thought that John the Baptist was the main event, not Jesus. And so John's spending a lot of time with his community saying, don't listen to those guys. but the other thing that's significant about Ephesus is that Ephesus was, from everything that we can tell, Ephesus was one of the best catechized communities in the ancient world. Paul spent 3 entire years living in Ephesus, catechizing them. You know, some places he goes to Thessalonica and he's there for like 2 weeks, and then he gets run out of town on a rail, and he's real worried about those guys because he's just barely established the community and then he had to leave. But with Ephesus, these are people who, you know, when your 2 of your principal teachers were St. Paul and St. John in the flesh for like decades, you're going to be a really well-catechized community.
Seems like.
Yeah.
That's a reason to believe that the Blessed Mother herself spent time in the community at the church at Ephesus. So that's more good elders.
Yeah. Well, listen, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Rod. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots.
Always fun.
Mark Shane. Our producer today was Ethan Bolin. And you were listening to the show. And thank you for doing so. I will be gone for the next few days, but be back on Tuesday. Until then, bye-bye.